Welcome back to another episode of Pop Culture Uncovered, where we answer one of the most timeless questions. Can Armand and Pete actually complete a podcast in Bell's absence? Only time will tell. Pete, in his infinite wisdom, decided that we should discuss, quite possibly, the greatest film to come out in 1985, one of the best films to come out in the 80s, and one of the best movies from the 80s that has aged well, especially involving nerds, where if you go back and watch Revenge of the Nerds now, but Real Genius is quite possibly one of the best teen movies I think I have ever seen before. And I say this as a John Cusack, you know, Better Off Dead, One Crazy Summer kind of guy. That was me as a kid in the 80s. I wanted to be John Cusack, you know. $2.
You just wanted to be in a Savage Steve movie. That's what it is.
Okay, yes, basically. I mean, we all had our aspirations.
This is the thing. You can't give me any credit because you recently watched this movie with your kids who actually enjoyed Real Genius.
I mean, they loved it. I mean, they loved the message of the film. They loved the idea of it. And it's funny because both, I feel like somehow like being a nerd over the course, you know, traveling from 1985 to, you know, to 2023, being like, this is a world of nerds now, right? The MCU is, you know, comic books were 100% nerd territory. And now, you know, they're ubiquitous. My kids are math and science guys. And so for them, it was Mitch and Chris, who are the main characters in Real Genius, were heroes that they could get behind because they were kids who were super great at science, who, when they realize the government is taking their unique research and turning it into a weapon, they go, hey, we gotta do something smart about it, like sabotage it. So Real Genius, 1985 science fiction comedy, that was a thing back in the 80s. Like, you know, Real Genius at the time fell into the same bucket of stuff like Weird Science, which I am not gonna discuss in detail tonight. But if you wanna have a unique 1980s experience, I would definitely encourage you to check it out. If you're worrying about it being socially appropriate, you don't have to, because it's not. But Real Genius was directed by Martha Coolidge, starring Val Kilmer as Chris Knight and Gabriel Jared as Mitch Taylor. And the premise is fairly simple. Mitch is a 15-year-old genius who has inadvertently become one of the leading authorities on lasers. And the United States government secretly is working with a pretend version of Caltech. I think it's Pacific Tech in the movie, but everybody who has seen it has said it's 100% Caltech. In 1985, the government has trying to develop a laser to basically be able to assassinate people from space. So think about what we want to do with like drones and stuff in the future, and that's basically what this movie was kind of foretelling. The CIA is secretly funding this program because ironically in real life, you know, the government cannot do secret research with universities. There's actually sunshine laws against that, so the activities are actually illegal. The CIA is secretly giving money to a Professor Hathaway, who was played
William Atherton, my favorite 80s villain. I mean, in everything. I mean, Die Hard,
Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters. He's so good at being the guy you hate.
He really, really is. And I have to say, I think he's at his most enjoyable in this movie because he gets a chance to be funny. And I think we got a chance to see a little bit of that, of him being funny in Ghostbusters. But I feel like Dr. Hathaway just takes it to an entirely new level. The scene where he's meeting Mitch's family, he's like, by any chance, was Mitch adopted? They're like, no. They're like, isn't it amazing? He's like, you have no idea. I just, you know, that dry kind of like sarcastic. And look, this is one of Val Kilmer's kind of early films. This is Val Kilmer before Top Gun. I think this is one of Val Kilmer's best performances. So I guess let's take it from there.
This movie, like, has been one of my favorites for a long. Like, it's been kind of a slow burn. Like, I love my Ghostbusters. I love all my Star Wars movies. And then sometimes I would just forget for a while that, like, Real Genius is there. And every time I come back to it, it's fresh, it's fun, it's exciting. Like, the two characters, you know, the way Chris Knight and Mitch Taylor evolve together through this movie is so much fun. You have, you know, Mitch, who is this like 15-year-old prodigy who has been brought in really to work on this laser project, but he just, you know, he's just, he just knows he's there. He gets to go to, you know, to university. He gets to get away from high school. He's excited. And then he finds that, you know, college is just as socially, you know, unaccepting as his high school experience was. And then in Chris Knight, you have, you know, this eccentric genius character that Val Kilmer, in his most Val Kilmer-y, is just bouncing around and playing. He's already been the Mitch, he's already been the smartest, and he feels like he's cracked the system, and like, I don't have to play along. So he's very much a class clown, he's very much a slacker, he's very much a, like, I can just get by on my wits and looks, and he kind of does, but you can see how quickly that's running out. Like, it is a testament to Val Kilmer's acting that you can see this, like, this young guy, this young genius, pretending to be so cavalier about things, and at the same time he's drowning, and it creates these really heavy undertones in a movie that is largely like pranks and gags and jokes. I mean, it's a smart movie, but it is very much, you know, it is very much a comedy, but these characters have layers, and like, you feel sadness for them and you feel like empathy for them, and I think that just drives this whole movie of like watching one kid grow up. It's kind of one guy find himself.
No, I think you're right. And I mean, I think it really is the actors and really the script that really kind of gives every single character some layers and some depth to them that makes, you know, like people forget, like, you know, college is a time period of transition. You're literally transitioning from being one version of yourself into another one. And I think the movie does a great job of kind of covering that kind of angsty, trying to find your way in the world and find your place, and, you know, what are your morals and your values, and what matters to you, and who do you want to be? And I think all those things, you know, really play strongly with it. I think to your point, Val Kilmer's performance as Chris Knight, I think he comes off as the very self-assured guy that, you know, has got a lot of insecurities on the inside, but isn't going to let them show. But I guess it's I enjoy how it would have been very easy for this movie to be basically Chris teaches Mitch how to be a grown up and be cool. And that's the story. It turns, what makes World Genius so special is there are times when Chris is mentoring Mitch, and there are times that when Mitch is mentoring Chris. So you get this strange relationship between this 20/21-year-old and this 15-year-old who are both learning from each other. And ironically, neither one of them is the smartest person living in their room, because the smartest guy to ever go to the school, Laszlo Hollyfeld, was the guy who he was admitted to college at Pacific Tech at 12 and cracked under the pressure. And he unexpectedly provides the real moral compass but ironically, not just in terms of how they need to perceive the dangers of their research, but also just the larger issues of life and being yourself and embracing who you are and realizing. It's funny. It's like, you know, I have sons that are very athletic. And so the worry is always they will focus on their athletic talents and not their academics, and somehow they'll be diminished as people. This movie speaks to the other principle. You can be super smart and have your intelligence. Pete, you said something great before we started recording tonight, how your intelligence can be commodified and used for somebody else's gain. And so it's that even being super smart has challenges and moral issues and things that you have to navigate. And I think the movie does a great job to touch on that. So I guess getting to the plot for a quick second, Mitch is brought in to assist on the development of this laser for this government assassination program. And then they've been struggling with the research. Dr. Hathaway may or may not be stealing funds from the project for the construction of his brand new house that's under development. And so he's now under pressure to produce a laser capable of meeting all the government's requirements, not a year from now the way it was planned, but within 4 months. And so the race is kind of basically Dr. Hathaway's putting pressure on them to come up with the laser to save himself. Well, of course, selling himself off as Dr. Hathaway in this movie is a bargain basement version of Carl Sagan, which kind of makes it even funnier. Because he starts recording a particular episode of his show, and it's talking about the power of the colon. So it's very nerdy, very smart movie. But so moving on from there, Chris and Mitch eventually end up coming with up with a solution for the laser after interference by our nemesis, who we're going to talk about now, Kent, our other big villain in the movie.
Right. Because every, you know, every villain needs a toady, and, you know, Professor Hathaway has his Kent, played by Robert Prescott, an actor who was in pretty much everything in the 80s. You know, he thinks of himself as sort of a, you know, the anti-Chris, that, you know, he makes it his life's mission to torment Mitch, and to feel like he can go toe-to-toe with Chris. And it's actually his antagonism that, like, actually ends up helping the project along. Mm-hmm. I love, though, that, like, for those of us who have collective nerds, this is the thing I when you mentioned, like, you know, being Star Wars geeks and Marvel geeks growing up, and so the, now that's sort of the culture. To me, there was always still a difference between nerds and geeks, because I had a lot of nerdy friends, and they were the ones who did really well in school. They were the ones, you know, who got straight A's. Ones like my wife who went to MIT, and it's them that I sort of get this perspective from, because, you know, I was just a knucklehead getting mediocre grades. And, you know, collecting comic books and watching way too much Star Wars and not applying myself. That's what every report card said. But to meet my wife's friends and people who were in that kind of world of, like, this, you know, high performing university where there's those pressures are so high and, like, the level of academics are so high, that there's so that you've met all of these people. You've met a Chris Knight or someone who thought they were. You've met a million Mitches, and there's a dozen, you know, and 100 Kents, and all these other characters that populate this movie are also so much fun. Like, you know, the knuckleheads that are in Kent's group, but also, you know, the ones that surround our main characters. We don't see nearly as much of them as it feels like we do. Like, there's some characters where, like, I don't even know if this person said a line, but the way they are directed in this movie,
they stand out, because the first person
stands
that
made, out. Yeah,
the exact thing I was thinking about was Bodhi. Bodhi is mm-hmm. is one of Kent's toadies, and there's this great scene where Kent's basically trying to argue for his value and the reasons why this 15-year-old Mitch should not be put in charge of this project. And at the end of it, Kent had arrogantly told Mitch that, you know, it goes from God to Jerry to me to you. And by the end of the conversation that Dr. Hathaway has with all the characters responsible for working on this laser, Bodhi goes, I guess it goes from God to Dr. Hathaway to Mitch to you to the cleaners. Right? Kent? and he's not being sarcastic. Bodhi is being Bodhi. It's like he's genuinely trying to figure out how the equation works. I think that is the single most significant line of dialogue that Bodhi has the entire movie. But if you watch Real Genius, the instant you see Bodhi, you will know Bodhi, and you will recognize him in every scene for the rest of the movie. One of the other characters that I did want to talk about before we kind of take a deep dive back into the plot is Jordan. Jordan was played by Michelle Menderick, who... this was actually one of her last roles. I loved Jordan in this movie, and I loved Miss Michelle's performance, because in the 80s there were such clear gender expectations of what a female character could be, right?
Right. And that Smurfette.
Yes. Right. Basically, Jordan is just as brilliant as the guys, but all we're talking about a group of really neurotic, really unique, really over the top characters. And Jordan fits in perfectly with all of them. The first time we see her, she's going down a staircase that has been iced over thanks to Ig's mysterious ice formula that evaporates, which Ig notes to everybody will be good as long as it doesn't explode, which he doesn't really mention to anybody until the ice is evaporating. But first time we meet Jordan, she's sliding down on it on this sled, and when she runs into Mitch, you know, he's like, are you okay? She's like, no, I'm upset. The drag coefficient on the blades was horrible. It should have gone much further, much faster. It's okay. You know, I'll take it back to my room and I'll make some edits.
The fun part about that, if you watch it, like, if you've watched it enough times and obviously you've lived through, you know, generations of change in, like, you know, and how characters are portrayed, the fun thing is we have, like, that kind of gag of, like, well, he asks if you know, she's okay, and she, like, spits, you know, all that entire line that I can never memorize. But, you know, she spits that entire line at him of science. It's like, it when she slides down, when she spits that line out, I feel like we're all supposed to be like surprised that, you know, she says something so sciencey. But the thing is that's what we would get in any other kind of movie. And then but every other time we see her, that's who she is. Yes. She's an inventor. She's, you know, she's hyperkinetic. Like she said, you know, she like spends all of her time doing things that she finds useful. And at no part of that movie is that really played for laughs. It's like, this is just who she is. You know, like she may do some silly things or invent some silly things and there may be a gag, but that sort of plays with every single one of the characters. But with, you know, with the Jordan character, it's just like who she is. In every scene, we kind of see her with something new that she's invented. And that's just accepted, you know, as much as any other of the business that any of these other characters have, you know, Chris's silliness and Mitch's, you know, like straight laced, you know, everything there just feels like, all right, that is absolutely a part of that person's character. And it's kept in a really consistent way. And also is just like, it's every part of that is embraced by every character. The characters in that crew embrace those strange things about themselves. And it just feels like a group of friends. And that's a really hard thing to convey when you really just have most of this movie is about the relationship between, you know, Mitch and Chris and, you know, and Jerry. There isn't a lot of room for these other characters to fit, but they feel so robust.
Yeah, no, I agree. For the record, I think Jordan has some of the best shadow comedy in the movie because it's not always overt, but there's a moment where she's talking to Mitch. She's like, yeah, you know, I never really sleep at night. You know, it drives some of my roommates crazy. One of my roommates, they took her away in an ambulance, but I heard she's doing much better now. And you realize that for Jordan, none of this is abnormal. Mitch is sitting there. He's just kind of borderline horrified, just like, what did you just say? But not to mention
he's
the fact
processing all right, of it.
Not to mention the fact that when Jordan realizes she likes him and she goes to make him a sweater and she walks into the men's bathroom like after he's woken up in the after Mitch has gotten up in the morning, he's trying to pee. Seeing how we're talking about things is funny. This is a science fiction comedy, so I wanted to take a moment to talk about the gags in this movie because, for the record, some of the gags are like everybody who ever dreamed of being a super smart, techie nerd kind of gag. And so I'll start with my favorite gag in the movie, Pete, which was the fact that Chris is so cheap that he has figured out, you know, I could take liquid nitrogen and freeze it. then I can slice it with the consistency of a quarter. And then I can use that to put it into the coffee machine to get free coffee. And it's the fact that the gag ties into that's how he comes up with the idea for the laser. Right. It's like Jordan's inventiveness is how they come up with the gag for Kent talking to God so they can get the information they need. Because it's not Mitch and Chris to come up with it, it's Jordan. But so the liquid nitrogen coin was my favorite gag. What was your favorite gag in the movie?
I think the funniest gag for me is just watching Chris try to be good again, try to be a good student, try to be like he was probably when he showed up, you know, as a freshman, when he was the Mitch, and he just cannot contain himself. So, you know, he shows up and he's all buttoned down, but, you know, he's got his bunny slippers. He, you know, aces the test, you know, gets ready to walk out early. And, you know, he just can't help himself but to hand that note. It's like, I aced this. He's taking notes. He's doing the performative study that he probably doesn't even have to do in order to. But even then, he's too much of a kid to let that opportunity slip. And so he continues to be the class clown. And we see how, like, a lot of this movie, a lot of what unfolds has to do with the fact that Chris cannot control those impulses. He is so over being there that he literally just cannot like keep himself out of trouble because you can tell he doesn't want to be there. You can tell he's past it and he doesn't even know what's going on. He doesn't even know all the sinister stuff behind it. He just knows that it just doesn't even feel right. And he clearly doesn't want to be there, but he stays almost just for Mitch.
Yeah. But it's funny because you raise that because you're right. Chris is kind of so consumed with kind of like his cynicism and he can't take anything seriously that he's not seeing the forest for the trees. He's not keeping his eye on the big picture about what are they really using this research for? And it's kind of interesting because now that you made me think about it in a strange way, the messaging behind Real Genius is pretty much the identical to what was in Oppenheimer, which is scientists have a tendency of wanting to create things because they want to create. They love the science of it, but they don't think about the policy implications. What are the long-term ramifications for the world, for the things that you're creating and the science that you're discovering? And I feel like that's a great moment where we have Laszlo, who's a character. They do a great job of making you think that Laszlo is going to be the most useless character.
Right, just the bonkers weirdo living in the steam room.
I got to pull up the actor's name. John Grease, who played like a ongoing series of like some of the quirkiest characters, you know, in the 80s. For the record, for anybody who loved the Monster Squad, he was the Wolfman. But just a great, great actor. But so you learn over the course of the film that one, as I kind of said earlier, Laszlo was the original number one smartest guy in the history of Pacific Tech before he cracked under the pressure. But two, he still got it. And your first kind of warning sign of the Chris tells Mitch, like, you know, Laszlo's smarter than both of us put together, just to be clear. And the first time you realize it is when Laszlo goes, oh, I see that you guys have been really stressed about studying for Dr. Hathaway's final. So I've consolidated every single question he's ever asked before on every exam in the history of the school. And Chris goes, is that what you're holding in your arms? He's like, no, these are entries into the Frito-Lay sweepstakes. Right. Based off my calculations, I'll earn 33.6% of all the prizes, including the car. And they're like, well, where are the questions and the test answers? He's like, oh, I memorized those. That's like your first warning about Laszlo. The next is when, after Kent has sabotaged the laser, which Mitch and Chris had got working, and Chris is forced to come up with an alternate way of developing a laser. Their goal was a 5-gigawatt laser beam, and they end up creating a laser beam that's so much more powerful that it burns a hole through the test dummy, through the bricks, through the wall, through most of the campus, and of course, ironically, because this is a science fiction comedy, through the sign for the Purgatory Burger. So there's a big big laser hole where the devil's there. Laszlo comes in and tells them, "Hey, have you thought about it all about what you're making?" And they literally go, "Oh, well, the scientific applications are endless. Let the commercial guys figure it all out. We've done whatever." He's like, "Well, you've made a 5-gigawatt laser at least that could basically be projected any place in the world, provided you had a mirror if you were in outer space. And it only lasts for 15 seconds. You're not building buildings with that." And then it's the slow realization of the, oh crap, what did we just make? And I guess I always love the theme of, you know, you get further with your friends than you do on your own. And it's the fact that for Chris and Mitch to fix what they've done, this death weapon that they've created, they need the brilliance of Jordan. They need Iggs' creativity. And Mitch and Chris both have to grow up in their own way. For the record, when you were talking about Chris and the gag behind I Aced This, you left off the fact that there was an exploding apple.
Oh,
he knew Hathaway would never eat the apple. So he intentionally gave him an apple because he knew he was going to throw it in the trash. So the apple goes off and blows the trash all through the room, which was just a perfect Chris move. I don't want to spoil the ending. I will just say, I think it's probably one of the most hopeful endings of a teenage film I have ever seen before, because the underlying premise is we are confronted with evil adults who are trying to take this thing we created and do something horrible with it. But there are good adults, congressmen, shocking, right? Try casting a congressman as a hero in a movie now and see how the audience receives it. But we're going to get the president of the university. We're going to get a congressman, and we're going to find a way of fixing this. I just think this is a really, really charming movie. I do want to talk about the music for a second. Look, the 80s was a great time period for music. And Pete, I'm going to kick this to you because you're my music aficionado. But the music of Real Genius is some of the best music of the time period.
Absolutely. I don't know what it is about that era, but you're absolutely right. Like, soundtracks were just like, I don't know what it was about that time in music. And, you know, the 80s in particular was just sort of rife with like all kinds of experimental music and sounds, and pop and pop adjacent music was still like very avant-garde and strange and cool. And like the soundtrack from the most familiar songs, like Tears for Fears, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, which I think the amazing thing about its use in that movie is like, I feel like everyone I know of our generation has like a personal connection to that song that is unique to them. And like, if you were to slap it in any movie, it would just feel like, no, that's not where that song goes. Like, that's, but it just fits in that perfect spot. It creates that weird 80s 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Saturday watching movies, you know, vibe of Saturday morning cartoons are over. You know, I don't want to go outside and play just yet. Like, this movie's on. And I feel like that's how I came to Real Genius. Like, that's how I found it. And so it will always kind of have that feeling. But there are songs like Falling by Comstat Angel. Like, this movie never had an official soundtrack that was released to my knowledge. And so you have like Chaz Jankel's Number One, which is featured in one of like the academic montages, which I wanted to stop for a second and talk about the fact that like I don't know of any other movie where there's, you know, an academic montage that just like hits you like you're watching you know, Rocky training for like the next fight. There is something about those two montages back to back in Real Genius that just feel like inspiring and cool in the way that like you would never expect that to happen. Yeah, there are like just songs that are catchy, and if you watch this movie enough times, you know these songs by heart, but you can't find them anywhere. I've spent years in Boston digging through record stores trying to find, you know, these artists and like original recordings, CDs, records, anything, and I always came up short. I am glad, once again, to be living in a YouTube era where I can find these songs at least one place and listen to them. But yeah, that of so many 80s soundtracks that stood out and had amazing music, this is one of like my top five, I think.
Oh yeah, I mean, look, I agree with you. I think the use of Tears for Fears, Everybody Wants to Rule the World, is probably one of the greatest uses, the greatest, most tonally perfect uses of a song in a movie that I can think of. And then the rest of the soundtrack is, for me, it's like a greatest hits. It's stuff that I was loving as a little kid, like Don Henley's All She Wants to Do Is Dance, which was a song that I was like was ubiquitous during, you know, its time period. The Bryan Adams, because you couldn't escape the 1980s without listening to Bryan Adams.
All right, One Night Love Affair, right? Is
Yep.
that in the song? Which
Yep.
is it's the song is everywhere, but it fits so well here. The new wave songs just have that like nerdy kind of feel. Like, yeah, I feel like people I knew who went to college and were these kinds of nerds listened to this kind of music and just knew these bands that I had never heard of that were just so like cool and
Yeah, no, and it was perfect for this time period. I'll just say thing. I'll do rapid fire things that we probably should have mentioned about this movie but didn't. One of the ways that our heroes are able to successfully determine what's going on is that they take their nemesis Kent and they knock him out with anesthetic, and they have Jordan attach a device to his braces, so that now he gets the impression that he can hear the voice of God. And the thing that convinces him of the fact that he's talking to God is when God tells him, and stop playing with yourself. And that's the moment that Kent 100% buys in. I should also tell you that Kent decides to torment Mitch by recording Mitch's phone call at home.
Oh, that hurts so much to
And then
listen.
playing the typical 15-year-old mom, I want to come home. Like, you know, I want to come home from summer camp. It's horrible. And the retribution they get on Kent in terms of disassembling his car and then reassembling it inside of his dorm room was absolutely beautiful. What else should I have mentioned about this movie that I did not? Go ahead,
I
Pete.
got a couple. Just the weird sexual jokes and sex. So not everything about this movie is like is super pure because we do have Sherry,
Sherry Nugent.
yeah, who was going around trying to like hook up with the number one, and so there she is like throwing herself at a 15-year-old Mitch, who's just like, I you feel that she's a predator. You know, and of course it's treated in in a funny way because it's the 80s, but like she's
I
a
mean,
fifth poor
I mean,
kid.
Pete,
At
I you,
least he escapes.
I think you're being a little unfair because she does tell him before she sleeps with him, I've been waiting for 3 years. Mitch is 15 in the
I
movie, y'all. She's been
don't like this at all.
stalking him since he was 12. But Pete, to your point, it does bring up a great moment with Mitch and Jordan, where like, look, in Eddie's movies, the trope was the guy sleeps with the wrong girl. The good girl that he should have dated finds out, and then he has to do something absolutely ridiculous to win the good girl back.
Right. It's insulting to everyone, and yes. It was everywhere. In the
yes, that was one of the most ubiquitous tropes of all through every 80s teen comedy movie. For once, our hero doesn't do that. Mitch is just like, I know I'm 15, I'm not entirely ready for all of this, but I realized that I don't want to sleep with Sherry Nugent. I want to sleep with you, Jordan. And it's done in such an endearing, dorky, I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm 100% sexually inexperienced. By the way, I'm also inexperienced in dealing with members of the opposite sex kind of way, that it's, despite its awkwardness, that moment is kind of endearing.
It is kind of sweet, and I like their relationship. This is one of those movies where I feel like it would make a really good Netflix series or some streaming series, where, you know, a movie remake people talk about every once in a while, and I think, man, it would just be done so terribly. And not that all streaming services based on books and movies or other shows that came before like do a perfect job, but I would just love for somebody to take a swing at this and spend some time, one, exploring all these characters, but also getting some things right or leaving some things out, or changing a few things, like maybe making, you know, Mitch and Jordan's, you know, ages just a little bit closer. Like, you know, he got there at 15. Why couldn't she have also gotten there the year before at 15? Maybe make them a year apart, 2 years. I don't know. So that's one of those things that I would probably do is you know, bring them closer in age, maybe change the Sherry Nugent character entirely. But there's things that about recreating this as a series or just recreating it that I would love to see somebody do, because it was already much more representative, much more like true to life than so many other things in the 80s were. When I talk to my wife and her friends, it is one of those movies that is like, that is so much more representative of the reality of going to a school like that, not just in the 80s but in the 90s and the 2000s, where it seems like those portrayals are still a little bit out of date, and somehow Real Genius got it right in 1985 with, you know, like just the diversity of the students who would be there and the way that they talk and the way that they interact and the way that they feel like nerds. And to that also is when we talked about, you know, the laser, the fact that like it feels like real science. Even when I was a kid, it felt different than listening to like science be regurgitated in Star Trek or any kind of sci-fi. The science that gets used in sci-fi movies, in sci-fi shows, it is just so loosely based. It's just such loose science that it has to be a space adventure for you to be immersed in that when the science can take you right out.
I was going
to
say really quickly, to your point on the science being science, that's because Martha Coolidge, the director, she spent months researching the laser technology and the policy of the CIA, interviewed a ton of students at Caltech. And if you watch the movie, there's a great sequence that Pete and I cackled about, and we should have mentioned it earlier, where Mitch is going to class, and gradually over time, there are fewer and fewer human beings, and there are more cassette tape recorders. The science professor himself stops showing up and does the math recordings. The math professor was actually a real scientist, and he was the scientific consultant for Real Genius. So he was on site and on set, which the consultant, whose name was Martin A. Gundinson, he literally ended up citing Real Genius in an academic publication that explained the science behind the laser in the movie. The only other movie that I could think of that had science that was that good was Interstellar, because the models they created for the black hole were the first accurate depiction of a black hole by a human being ever. So it's Real Genius and Interstellar in terms of real science. Go ahead, Pete.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. When I talk to people who went to colleges like these, there is like a loyalty, like a like, you know, you got us right kind of feel to it. So it's funny because it does have like a kind of beloved status, at least among the friends that I have who went to these types of institutions, you know, several friends who went to MIT and, you know, who I've seen the places they lived, you know, where they're, you know, like a Coke machine front, you know, served as the door to someone's room, and, you know, Just leaving the pantry door open was enough for like a whole sequence of like lights and sounds and everything to happen as an alarm that goes throughout the building. People who are teenagers and in their early 20s doing the same kinds of things we do, but with an engineering and computing background that allows them to do just like hilarious, creative, and strange things for no reason. And I think that's why a lot of people I know like love Jordan's character. She never doesn't have a gadget. You know, she rolls in with, you know, with all sorts of tech, even like silly things like the page turning, you know, device that is, you know, just unwieldy. But the fact that like she just came up with it and made it, and that's just a form of expression. This is creating something that few people would even think to make. And this is just a character in a movie, but it feels, you know, like everything else. And it just feels very honest. You know, even with the liberties it takes, science-wise, like the science feels honest, the scientists feel honest, you know, the pressures, you know, from studying and doing what they're doing with the laser, like you feel that pressure, you know, when Mitch, shows up at, you know, when Mitch goes looking for Chris and Chris is throwing a party, you get that feeling that like Chris is like, this is what I have to do to keep myself from just like snapping. And so all of that just, you know, feels like somebody who went to this school, you know, it feels like somebody who went to Caltech wrote a movie about going to Caltech.
No, and hey, that's real genius. I mean, look, I take no shame in saying, like, you know, real genius sits up there for me with The Last Starfighter, The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, in terms of movies from the 80s that, like, I have been overjoyed to expose my kids to. And I think it says a lot about the themes and how great the movie is that the only thing I really had to explain to my kids were the boom boxes and the cassette tape recorders. The rest of the stuff they were able to follow just fine. So, I mean, I think Real Genius is a movie that's got it's got a great message. It's got lots of really interesting science, to be perfectly honest. And it's got some extraordinarily well-written characters, and it's done by a really talented cast. And it's done by, look, I'm going to be really honest, by a really fantastic director. Martha Coolidge had an absolutely stunning career. I mean, while we were talking, I was kind of just like, oh, I wonder what else she did. And it's like, oh, she did Introducing Dorothy Dandridge, which might have been Halle Berry's, the single biggest star-making role Halle Berry ever had. And to be perfectly honest, one of the major Black history movies of the time period. But Martha Coolidge went on to direct almost every single television show that you could think that you cared about, from The Twilight Zone to Sex and the City to CSI Criminal Investigation to Weeds to Psych. So,
I mean, go all the way back, she directed Valley Girl. Like, you know, yeah, like, right? Another seminal 80s movie that had, you know, a lot more heart than you would expect.
No, exactly. And so I almost don't want to see a remake. Because I feel like it would be a considerable challenge to try to make a new version of Real Genius that feels as authentic as the original did, but is able to kind of preserve the heart of the movie. Because the one thing I will say about this, it would be very easy for this movie to reduce itself down to like a series of mean, malicious pranks between characters. Our good guys are good people. And that actually matters. Like, you're rooting for Chris. You're rooting for Chris to finally take life serious in some way, but still maintaining his lighthearted nature. You're rooting for Mitch to be able to grow up and be a little more mature, but also understand the balance that needs to be in life. You're looking forward to Dr. Hathaway getting taken down. And boy, without spoiling the plot, I think it's one of the best ways to dispose of a villain that I've ever seen before, because they literally literally ended up bringing everything he hated right to his house and left him
in the best way.
So no, it's just a great movie with a great soundtrack, with special effects that actually hold up surprisingly well, considering it was made in 85. There's an initial kind of Star Wars-esque kind of intro that I thought was going to look really hammy and really crappy after all my years of Marvel CGI. And I was like, it's disturbing that this looks almost as good as some stuff that I've seen in a Marvel movie before. So Real Genius is highly rated by PCU. I'm sure, like, you know, if it was like a Rotten Tomato score, I would tell you my score would be kind of 92, 94. there's very little about this movie I would change. Besides getting Chris Knight to explain to me the concept of how to make the liquid nitrogen coins, which I'm still really interested about. But no, that's real genius. Definitely encourage you to check it out. If you enjoy this episode, let us know, because Pete and I would love to do more deep dives on movies that we grew up with. We, of course, are Pop Culture Uncovered. You can support us on Patreon. Search for Pop Culture Uncovered. Definitely, wherever you listen to the podcast, please subscribe and like and rate the show. It helps us get the good word out. Catch us on social media. Just search for Pop Culture Uncovered. And I would be incredibly remiss if I did not mention the fact that we also have a website with some really great articles covering all the stuff that we're kind of talking about tonight. So definitely check that out. That, of course, is popcultureuncovered.com. And we'll see you back next week. Have a good one. Don't be a Kent. Don't be a Dr. Hathaway.